We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 123.
On today's show, we talk about gnawed Neanderthal bones, ancient Sicilian wine, and modern versus ancient human diets.
Let's dig a little deeper.
All right, welcome to the show, everybody. How's it going?
Hello, good.
So, man, I don't even know what day it is. We've been just a little dive into our personal lives. We've been driving every single day for the last eight, nine days now. Sunday. So for the last eight days now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're getting from, we're going from Massachusetts to Nevada to do some archaeology.
Yeah. So 8 days ago we left Massachusetts. We are now in Wyoming, and I think the constant travel is starting to wear on us a little bit.
Yeah. Because we work full time.
Yeah.
We do long days on the weekends, but during the week, we're only doing a couple hours, maybe 2-3 hours a day, mm-hmm. Before basically my meeting schedule. And yep. It's a lot. So anyway,
for that's sure.
Neither here nor there. So,
well, it was there and now it's here.
It's both here and there.
So it's,
I thought I was supposed to make the dad jokes.
Usually it is you, but I couldn't let that one go.
All right. So what is the Neanderthal story of the week?
Neanderthal story of the week. I feel like we should just bookmark one segment for Neanderthals every week. There's just like a resurgence in research into them. Is it?
We're just paying attention.
Is it that we're paying? I don't know. I feel like people are just more interested in them now.
No. Scientists don't do research because people are interested in them.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the major news sources are picking up a lot of Neanderthal stuff lately because we first saw this article on CNN and they titled it "Gnawed Bones of 9 Neanderthals Found in Italian Cave," which is like, usually they're over the top with their headlines. Mm. And this one is not that bad. There's nobody surprised or astounded, which is great.
Yeah. So what's going on here?
So basically, there's a cave in Italy called the Guattari Cave, and this cave was originally found in the 1930s, and a couple remains were found in there, but there's a lot of blockage and they just weren't able to like do full excavation back in the day. And recently people have gone back in to get these blockages out of the way and do like a more thorough excavation, and they have found 9 new remains. Plus, there were 2 from the previous excavation. So that makes a total of 11 Neanderthals found in one cave, which is like kind of a lot of Neanderthals to be found in one cave. So that's sort of why this is so interesting and different and exciting.
And these bones, these Neanderthal bones, mm-hmm. have what look like cut marks in them. Well, not cut marks, but marks that don't look like they were born.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's clear signs of 9, hence the title of the article. They think it's probably by hyenas or a hyena type animal. And the big question is they don't know if the Neanderthals were dead when the 9 happened or if they were killed by the animal. Mm-hmm. So kind of a horrific thought to consider there that they were... they were mauled by hyenas and then killed.
Yeah.
And then their bones were gnawed on. But who knows? But yeah, so the Neanderthals that they found, they were able to date them. And one of them does date back to like 90,000 to 100,000 years ago. Mm. And then the other 8 date back to 50,000 to 60,000 years ago.
That's a huge span of time.
Isn't it? Yeah. So, it's a little unclear if all of the bones show 9 from hyenas and like why there would be such a big time span between the older one and then the newer ones. But mm-hmm. that it is interesting though, because it does show that this cave was preferred by those people at that time. So they definitely were going back to it often over the years. So that's one interesting thing. So yeah.
And they never went back and we're like, man, those bones there. Oh, well.
Yeah. And like, because this isn't an article in like an archaeology journal, it doesn't say like as far as depth that the bones were found at, yeah. like yeah. was one deeper, sure, therefore buried. Older. Yeah.
It's a cave. I mean, caves by nature are made typically either because of some geologic instability, more likely because of like water and stuff flowing mm-hmm. through them over millions and millions and millions of years. They, you know, erode out and make these caves. So because of that, they often have, you know, water brings in sediment with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, ceilings collapse, all kinds of stuff happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, for sure.
Although the reconstruction, like there's a drawing and it looks like a more of a rock shelter kind of on the front of it. There must be some caves kind of going back in there. Again, we don't have the original article, but.
Yeah. And they definitely said that there was like blockage and.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, it says an ancient earthquake and then a more recent landslide mm-hmm. had made parts of the cave inaccessible. So
right.
that's part of the reason why some of this stuff was buried and some wasn't and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
So do you remember how you can tell that these were more likely nod marks and not cut marks? Like it wasn't some sort of form of cannibalism or something like that? Like cut by a tool.
Right. Because it would be like a straight cut if it were cut by a tool and then... Well, gnawing would be a different type of...
Well, there's a very clear way to tell. Gnawing is usually done by your canines, your canine uh-huh. teeth, and those leave a U-shaped groove.
Oh.
Whereas a cut mark with some kind of a tool or a knife, and by knife I mean like stone knife, mm-hmm. has a V-shaped groove.
Oh,
so it's a
okay.
pretty clear indication when something has been cut with some sort of tool and something has just been gnawed on. Because even if a human is going to gnaw on bones, typically it's going to have a U-shaped groove because our teeth are shaped that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that is an interesting point to bring up because one of the things they said is that there were ventilation holes in the ceiling of the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the bones were also burned. So that led to speculation that perhaps there was cannibalism going on, which I think is a bit of a reach.
I mean,
but
maybe it's just that this was a great cave to be in and somebody came by and there were just like bodies in there from the recent hyena activity. And, you know, bodies stink and are gross. So burn them and get rid of them.
Oh, that's possible. You know? Yeah. Like some sort of funerary yeah. situation, whether
either that or just cleaning up.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's definitely possible. I don't know. That definitely seemed like the writers of the news article were kind mm-hmm. of reaching because, you know, the word cannibalism is always something that sparks interest in people
yeah.
reading. So, yeah.
Yeah. Caves are also cool too, because, you know, they just get layered with sediment year after year. And one of the other things the authors were doing with this cave study, this current cave study, and probably looking at some past excavations as well, but they're looking at the sediment to take a look at climate change
mm-hmm.
because it represents, you know, 60 to 120,000 years of animal species and pollen.
Yeah.
So if you just look, you might not be able to tell the layers year after year, like you're looking at the rings of a tree, but in some cases you can, especially if it fills with water, then you get those laminar sediments like you do at the bottom of a lake. But if it doesn't, I mean, simply just looking at the pollen, you can tell species of plants from 80,000 years ago versus 60 versus 40 versus 20.
Yeah.
And same thing with the animal species. Were there any that are extinct now that you're seeing in lower layers?
Right.
Stuff like that. So it's pretty cool. A lot of stuff we can tell from just this one cave. Caves are like literal treasure
yeah,
troves.
Yeah, they're
of
data. Like archaeology gold.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing, too, that they're saying is that they hope to do more excavation to find tools, which mm-hmm. I took that to mean that they did not find any tools in the excavations that have happened so far. So that'll be interesting because if they don't find any tools or any other evidence of, you know, domestic use of the cave, then that I feel like would give more credence to the thought that the hyenas killed them and dragged them back there to eat them rather than humans were like occupying this cave. So
yeah,
Neanderthals.
And that if there was fire, then maybe they did ritualistically burn them.
Yeah.
You know, if they're not going to hang out there for a while.
Right.
They like to leave their stuff around.
Yeah, for sure.
So, all right. So that's pretty cool. So let's go from there and celebrate with a glass of wine. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS.
Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 123 of The Archaeology Show. I'm going to start saying it like Ohio State and say The Archaeology Show. It's not Archaeology Show. It's The Archaeology Show. I don't know why they do that. It's got to be a reason for it.
I don't know. It's always been The Ohio State. Please don't come and murder us in our sleep, Ohio people. He does not know what he says.
I know. I'm not a sports ball guy, so I don't really know, but I have heard that kind of stuff before. So anyway, welcome back to The Archaeology Show. And now we're going to talk about wine. And as we're making our journey across the country, we are using a service called Harvest Hosts, which basically gives you, I'm putting in scare quotes here, like free camping at wineries, distilleries, places like that. But we end up spending more on wine because they say patronize the people that you're at, right? Like, we're currently at a bowling alley in Evanston, Wyoming, and we are going to go have some of their wings and maybe bowl around.
For sure. I'm like pretty excited about that. So let's get this segment going here. I know,
it's our duty as Harvest Host members to go do that. We're doing the service. Now, anyway, it brings money and stuff to local communities, things like that. So we like to support that. But anyway, you know, wine is definitely on our minds. And maybe when I found this article, that is why I clicked on it. But the article is entitled How Scientists and Archaeologists Trace Beer and Wine Through Antiquity. Now, this is from Wine Enthusiasts, but to their credit, they actually link to the PNAS article, which is the original article entitled Chemical Evidence for the Persistence of Wine Production and Trade in Early Medieval Islamic Sicily.
And that is an open source journal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
That's cool.
So, and one of the cool things I liked about this was, I mean, first off, their study area, pre-Islamic Sicily. Let's just put that together for a second right now, because what that really means is, and I wrote this down. So Sicily, the area of Sicily, which is the island off the boot in Italy, that's actually not that far from, well, not that far from the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump across the Mediterranean.
Right.
I say that having done that in the USS Enterprise and standing there seeing like 18-foot swells on the Mediterranean on a clear day. So,
yeah.
Not, I mean, exactly easy.
Attacking that kind of a sail back in the day would have been pretty difficult, but.
Yeah. Of course, you could have walked there too. You should just go around the long way.
Oh my God. That would take forever.
Well, you know, people did it. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, it was under Islamic control, which I'm not exactly sure what that means. Like, which Islamic countries or areas actually had that area under control, but it was for a lot longer and much more recent than I ever would have expected. And it says 5th to the 11th centuries.
Oh, no way.
AD.
Yeah. Oh, so, okay. So Sicily would have been under the control of the Romans at the height of Roman Empire, right?
Yeah.
And then when they started to sort of dissolve, then I'm guessing whatever Islamic group came in and took control of the island until they finally lost it in the Middle Ages?
I guess so. And it would be real interesting to see, because you think, when I think of Sicily, I mean, I've never been to, I've been to Italy a few times, but when I think of Sicily, I think of, you know, pizza. And, you know, Sicilians and, you know, all that, like
Sicilian mobs.
Sicilian mobs. I mean, they, all the typical Italian stuff I think of when I think of Sicily.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder, like, how much Islamic architecture and influence is actually in Sicily?
I would imagine a lot, because I don't know a whole lot about Sicilian culture necessarily, but I do know that like the food and some of the traditions there can be very different from mainland Italy. So I'm sure there's a lot of different stuff there, and it must be because of this influence from the Islamic culture that that ruled for, gosh, how long? Like 800 years, it sounded like. Well, you said
six, 700 years.
So that's cool.
So anyway,
one of the things that was really cool, there was a researcher, she's a postdoctoral fellow, I think it is, Leah Drew. D-R-I-E-U. We're going to link to the original PNAS article as well. But she's from the University of York. She's a chemist, and she studies the eating and drinking habits of the past. So she's like an archaeochemist.
Cool. That's very neat. Yeah,
which is actually cool because a co-founder of this network, Tristan Boyle, studied archaeochemistry in his program. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, she uses organic residue analysis to confirm the chemical fingerprint of wine on ancient pottery. And it gets really deep into the weeds here when you look at the article. But specifically, again, she was looking at the wine that was traded in pots from Sicily while under that Islamic control. So tartaric acid is basically crystals that grow in wine as it ages. And in fact, apparently tartaric acid and those crystals, those kind of crystalline forms, are looked for by wine enthusiasts in really old wines.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I liken it to like a really sharp cheddar. It's got to be a similar process.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because a really sharp cheddar, when you get up into like the 5, 6, 7, 8 year range,
it's crystally.
They have those crystals in them. And I don't know if it's as a result of tartaric acid. I'm not really sure.
And I wonder too, like in wine, I know what it's like in cheese, but in wine, is it visible crystals or is it like, are they microscopic? I wonder how that works.
Right. Well, the thing is, other things can also create tartaric acid, other fruits, stuff like that.
Okay.
When it's just kind of
anything
left.
That can ferment, I would assume.
I mean, kind of, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, so, So then she looked at malic acid, which is also found in sour fruits. She looked at unripe grapes, tamarind, wine itself, grape juice, and vinegar. And she ended up coming up with the fingerprint is basically the ratio between tartaric acid and malic acid is different in grape products as compared to most other fruits.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then you can take this study a little bit farther, and which I think is kind of like the nail in the coffin for this whole thing. Like, why wouldn't you just kind of do this first? But I mean, if you don't have DNA analysis, that's one thing. But a lot of times when you have these wine production areas, you will find seeds, you will find the skins of grapes around. And that's a good clue that they weren't just eating these grapes like table grapes. They were peeling them for processing.
They were squishing
them for some reason because they made vinegar out of grapes. They made just grape juice out of grapes. Mm-hmm. And then they let it ferment into wine as well. So they did actually quite a few things. But anyway, using the ratio between tartaric and malic acid and then looking at the DNA analysis from grapes, basically you could say not only are these typically wine grapes that we found, but also judging by what's in these pots here, this was definitely, you know, some kind of wine. Mm-hmm. So that is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
They also, using that DNA analysis, were able to find an exact match to modern, and I'm going to pronounce this right, Sauvignon Gramps, grapes. S-A-V-A-G-N-I-N, grapes. And not just like a descendant, but an exact match, which means that the branch clippings from, you know, a grapevine 900 years ago has propagated 900 years all the way up until when they sampled
it.
That
is so cool.
Yeah. So
that is so neat.
Vineyards have been like that for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And also horticulturalists.
Yeah.
They'll take something. It didn't take them very long to figure out a long, long time ago, thousands of years ago, that if you take a piece off of one plant, you throw it in the ground, you're going to have another plant.
Yeah. The same exact plant, basically.
But they may not have known it was the same exact plant back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the same exact plant.
Yeah.
Right, genetically.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's so neat.
So anyway, lots of cool stuff that they're doing there. There's one thing I thought it was interesting. The article in Wine Enthusiast made it sound like she invented organic residue analysis, but I'm pretty sure she didn't. she's just using that as a tool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but that's pretty neat because the fact that you can get it off of pottery, enough of it off of pottery, it probably means to me that it wasn't just like discarded pottery that was empty, like it was just like out of wine, so they chucked it or something like that. It was probably pots that had been either forgotten about, left in a building, something happened, and the wine evaporated through time and you're left with a lot of residue.
Yeah.
Maybe not even visible to the naked eye, but enough that you can extract it from the pottery. Well,
and I wonder if reusing the same pots over and over and over would give the same kind of thing because it just seeps in over time. And yeah, you might not be able to visually see it, but it just is into the fiber of the ceramic basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So
cool.
Anyway, yeah, that's pretty neat. This is a a good article in the fact that in the Wine Enthusiast article actually goes into beer quite a bit too. I just kind of focused on the wine. And they actually do talk about beer in the PNAS article as well.
Yeah.
So definitely head over and check that out. It's got its own idiosyncrasies, but kind of along the same lines of doing the organic residue analysis and the genetic analysis as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty cool.
And like, what were conclusions or were there not really conclusions drawn? It was just showing how this process can work.
Yeah, I mean, really what they were looking for is they were trying to identify it.
Okay.
Like, where was this? Where did this come from?
So the conclusion was, can you find this residue and date it, basically?
Can you...
Or identify it.
Can you identify it?
Okay.
Yeah, because I don't think they could necessarily date it.
Right.
Yeah, but they could definitely identify it and note that it was a certain type. And then if they have... It's like you take anything else like obsidian. Obsidian is a chemical fingerprint from a volcano, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they studied these Sicilian pots, and it was an Islamic society, they can now do this residue analysis on pots maybe found in some Islamic countries where they might have those and say, hey, this wine totally came from Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just being able to identify that. And then using this process, I mean, there is wine all over the Mediterranean.
Right.
Right. Just everywhere. So being able to understand the chemical analysis and fingerprint these wines and their points of origin will help better understand Mediterranean trade networks.
Yeah.
So, and maybe even global trade network, well, at least hemispheric trade networks, because they work from over here.
I'm seeing what you're saying. Like, we could potentially see like this specific wine residue all over Europe, and then we can see how it was moved around the continent, basically.
Yeah, wouldn't it be cool to find like some Sicilian wine somewhere up in northern England or something like that?
An old pot.
Yeah. You know, just like the journey that wine would have taken, and then, you know, people enjoyed it up there, and just it would have been a thing.
Yeah,
so that
definitely
would have been really cool. Food has always been one of those elite sort of commodities where, you know, I mean, all going back, I mean, I don't even know if there's a start. It's just been always, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you have something that is hard to get and sought after, you're seen as above.
Yeah, for sure.
Wine and food. I mean, just to say that you've got wine from Sicily, you know, whatever it was called back then. I don't even know if it was called Sicily, but you've got wine from here. They're like, ooh, wow, you're rich and famous, you know. So that's literally
status symbol for sure. Yep.
The only thing that's kind of changed is now we just try to get the rare stuff that's more expensive to have our statuses, because, you know, when we were on the East Coast, we were buying wine from Lodi, California in the store, like in the grocery store, right? So,
yeah.
Or whatever stores they have on the East Coast, the crazy wine stores. So it's a little harder to do. So you got to get the ultra rare stuff.
Yeah.
So in fact, I was reading this book, just one last little story here. I was reading this book. Well, I've been listening to this book as we've been driving. It's called Flip the Script by Orrin Hatch, I think his last name is. Anyway, he was just talking about a story where he was, you know, at this exclusive party, basically talking to the bartender, and he's talking about, you know, having your status, like establishing your an equal status with somebody who you're trying to negotiate with. And he gave his knowledge to the bartender, trying to find out if this was just a weekender bartender or a real bartender. And the woman he was talking to, he was like, what do you have? And she's like, oh, we got these things. It was like Corona, Bud Light. And he's like, really? And she's like, wasn't my call, man. And he's like, man, he was like, not too long ago, I got to have a, what do you call it? Like a torpedo tactical nuclear penguin or something like that. And apparently it was like this beer that like 1,000 bottles of it were made. And now it is so rare and sought after. It goes for something like $1,000 to $5,000 a bottle.
What? Really?
Yeah,
what makes this so special?
I have no idea.
That's crazy.
I think what made it special is it was served to the right people and there was a limited quantity and they made a demand for it.
Right.
So now there's bottles floating around that people bought up. And if you have one or you see one, it's like this thing.
All right. Yeah. Well, so, keeping an eye out for that, I guess.
Anyway. All right. So with that, we are going to take our final break and we're going to come back and get into the weeds with another PNAS article, nitrogen isotope perspectives and things like that. But it's basically talking about modern and ancient diets and comparing the two. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to episode 123 of the Archaeology Show, and we are going deep into some science for this one.
But more food stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. More food stuffs. Yeah. We're hungry right now. We haven't had a very good lunch, and we just want food.
Oh, my God. We're going to start sounding like Alex from Animals.
Yes, that's right. All right. Anyway. So this is also from PNAS, like the last one. And PNAS, for those that don't know, there's a lot of open source stuff on here, but it's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, to use their full title. Mm-hmm. This was published on May 11th, 2021, and it's called A Global Carbon and Nitrogen Isotope Perspective on Modern and Ancient Human Diet. Now, I will tell you, this thing really quickly goes deep into the weeds on chemistry.
It does. I read the abstract and I was like, cool, got this. I'm here. I'm with it. And then I started reading the full article, and like I felt myself start like skimming more than reading, because I was like, oh, dear God, there's a lot of science here and my brain is not absorbing all of it.
Right. I can't even say the symbol that they use here. I can't remember what it's called. It's like, what is this, a lowercase omega or something? I'm not really sure.
I don't know.
But anyway, one thing, you don't feel guilty for not reading the article, because one thing I actually heard recently from a college professor was the best way to read basically a lot of scholarly articles, because these can get really detailed, is you understand how the article is written. So definitely start with the abstract.
Yeah.
Then go all the way to the conclusion.
Yes.
It's either the conclusion or results. Sometimes they call it different things, but whatever the final word on whatever they did is, because usually those two things are written in somewhat plain, unjargoned English.
Yes.
And you can just, okay, this is really good here. And also go through after that and look at the figures.
Yeah.
Because the figures will give you an idea. Now, if you think that for whatever you're researching or studying that you need to dive deeper into it and say, yeah, but at locality 5, what really did they find here? Like, you just need to dive into it, right?
Well, if it's your area of study, then of course you're going to be that interested in it. But
maybe not. It depends on what you're trying to figure out, right?
Well, because
the whole reason, the whole thesis about a scientific paper and how these things are written is replicability. So they have to put in their methods. They have to put in exactly what they had. That's why you'll find massive tables of spreadsheet data in reports. And a lot of times these spreadsheet data are actually in supplemental materials that aren't included in the paper anymore. They're some other PDF or downloadable material that you can actually get. Because they have to include that stuff. You're looking at replicability. Other people are going to say, oh, well, I'm going to try this in my lab. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to try this on my computer. And I'm going to try to do the same thing. Here's exactly how they did it. Yes, I got the same results. Bam. Now you have correlation. So
yeah. Well, as far as reading the article goes, I am definitely going to be the first to admit that I read the abstract. I started the article and then I skipped to the results, I think they called it in this article.
Right. I think most people naturally just kind of do that. I'm just saying, make it official. Just skip to the results.
Just do it. It's great.
Yeah. So anyway, the point of this article, so they looked at 13,666 modern human collagen and keratin samples. So collagen is hair?
Yeah.
Yeah, hair and keratin. Isn't that like fingernails or something? Or do you get keratin in hair as well?
No, I think it's hair and fingernails.
Hair and fingernails, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you learn a lot about somebody's diet by looking at their hair and their fingernails,
right?
You learn a lot of stuff about that. And these guys didn't do their own study. They looked at other reports that, again, had these tables of data in them. They had already done the sampling. They'd already sent off for results. And they were looking at some of the chemical signatures within these results. It might not even have been the original purpose of the paper that sent off the samples to get analyzed.
It was all modern humans, or it was ancient and modern? Well, it was a mix.
When they say modern human, we're talking about Homo sapiens.
Okay.
We're not talking about Homo erectus. We're not talking about Neanderthals.
Right.
So when we say modern humans, we're going back 200,000 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we're going to get into finer detail on this here in a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
This macro study of these 13,666 samples were, I don't know if I read deep enough to see what regions it crosses, but basically it was from a lot of different places and it was from a lot of different populations. So current modern populations, and by modern in this case, I mean, you know, post-industrialization.
Right.
And then also modern like subsistence societies, like hunter-gatherer societies that still exist today.
Right.
But also prehistoric peoples and pre-industrialized modern peoples.
Right. It sounds like they split these samples up to pre and post industrialization and also to subsistence and urbanized or non-subsistence populations, whatever you would call that.
Right.
So that's how they were like splitting them up and then comparing them to, you know, prehistoric examples. So
they needed something to, I guess, measure all these against, right? So they created a what they called a reference frame called the modern diet equivalent. So it's this metric that they came up with. If you want to know more about that, again, read the details of the paper. But they use this modern diet equivalent concept to compare modern human diets. And again, like I just said, human diets prior to the advent of industrialized agriculture and the natural environment. And by natural environment, it just means people just eating off the natural environment like right now, like hunter-gatherers, basically.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... And we say industrialized agriculture because agriculture, sure, agriculture invented 10, 12,000 years ago, definitely changed the way humans eat. And you would probably focus a lot more on certain foods because you're growing them and you have a lot more of them right there. But industrialized agriculture really changed things when you started having these large factory farms, you know, just pumping stuff out. So that's really what their metric was for that. And what it revealed was what we can probably basically guess, but it's nice to have the paper and research to back it. But it revealed that humans that are pre-industrialized agriculture and humans that are subsistence cultures today have a much broader diet than people who are non-subsistence food eaters, like most of us are, to be honest, right now. Even if you have a garden in your backyard and you go to the farmer's market every weekend, your diet's not as broad as somebody who, you know, pre-industrialized agriculture. It's just simply not.
It's somebody who's just living off the land and what is around them ends up eating a much broader diet.
Yeah. One of the ways that they characterized that statement was they say humans have the ability to consume opportunistically as extreme omnivores within complex natural food webs, which basically means we'll eat anything. And when your life depends on it and your family's life depends on it and you've got 15 screaming children right there going, I am hungry. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're going to find something to eat. Yeah. You're going to be like, wow, that tree bark does actually look good now. Mm-hmm. Oh, turns out it's got maple syrup on it. No, that's not how that works.
No, that's not how that works at all. I was going to say, like, that's how insects and crickets and things come into play, right? Yeah. Because they're actually like a really great source of protein.
That's right.
And a lot of communities do eat them on the regular. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, humans, you just think of, even if you've never been to one, and I haven't been to like any authentic ones, but you think of like Asian markets and stuff like that. A lot of the stuff that they eat over there would just be people in the Western world is just repulsed by. But it's just what they've eaten their whole culture. And they didn't go into industrialized food production until way later than, say, the rest of Western world, like the Asian societies did not. So they still have a lot of those cultural things that are just, you know, accepted.
Yeah.
That they eat.
Yeah.
Like India, Africa, places. Mm-hmm. Though,
yeah. Makes for a much broader diet. So as far as overall health goes, I'm guessing it's a good thing. So One thing I thought was interesting about this article is because I was like, well, we know what people were eating in the past, right? Like we know from burned remains of hearths and things like that. Like we know what they were eating. Mm-hmm. But what this article pointed out and what I thought was kind of the most interesting is that, yes, we know what they were eating in the past, but we don't know what proportions they were eating it in. Sure, we know they were eating corn, they're eating wheat, they were eating meats of some sort, but how much of each? We just didn't know. But this study is what's helping like narrow in on what those proportions were and helping, you know, just give a better idea of what like the diet and the life of prehistoric people were. So that was a really cool takeaway for me from this article.
We all hear the phrase, you are what you eat. I mean, that's quite literally true with some things, right? The stuff that's in the food that you eat leaves a fingerprint literally inside of your body.
Right.
Yeah. And you can really tell, like, we've known for a long time how to tell some of the macro things, like were they, you know, subsisting on fish products and marine products more so than, say, land-based products. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty easy to tell in somebody's diet by looking at their hair, their fingernails, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, it also helps that they lived in huts by the water. You can probably guess that too, but it's nice to have this correlation.
Yeah.
You know, and the more we refine this science, the more we might be able to refine, I mean, even more things about somebody's diet. You know, there's Ötzi the Iceman who was found up, was it the French Alps or the Spanish Alps up in that area?
Yeah, something like
anyway,
that.
He was found and they were able to actually, not just from his actual stomach contents, but they were able to retrace the areas he was likely to have been based on the levels of certain chemicals within his body, because he was essentially preserved in the ice, right? So there's a lot of stuff about him that they could still sample and test.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. One of the things, again, that came out of this study was some actual numbers here is they said that the dietary breadth across modern non-subsistence populations, which is pretty much everyone listening to this podcast, has compressed by as much as 2/3 as a result of the rise of industrialized agriculture and animal husbandry practices, which means when they say animal husbandry practices, I mean, we're eating a lot less variety of like small and large game.
Yeah.
Like we're eating a lot of chicken and beef.
Yeah. And pork.
Chicken, beef, and pork.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not putting a lot of other game on our, on our menus. So now we just drive across Wyoming. They may beg to differ. There's a lot of like, I think in, it was either Nebraska or Wyoming in the last couple of days, I saw a place that was just like the big game cafe or something like that. I don't know what they serve.
Probably. <So. laughs> Yeah. I don't know.
Probably
actually.
Some venison, I would imagine.
Buffalo maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that is super interesting. It makes you wonder if maybe the paleo diet, maybe there's something to that. Maybe it's not just a fad diet. Maybe go research that and at least take the broadening of your diet aspect from it. 'Cause I'm sure that's part of it. I don't really know anything about paleo diet, but
okay, well, let's get into the paleo diet for a second because a lot of people do bring that up, right?
Yeah.
They think, well, let's not eat any processed foods because obviously they didn't have processed foods back in paleo times.
Yeah.
Whatever, it's like olden times for prehistoric people, right?
It's
like, what does paleo times even mean? Right. So, but they didn't have any processed foods prior to our ability to process foods.
Right.
I mean, along those lines, neither did Victorian England, right? They didn't have processed foods either.
Not today's processed foods. Yeah, that's
not
for
processed
sure.
In the way that we think of processed foods, right? So and then again, what is food processing? Is wine a processed food? Is cheese a processed food? You know, I mean, I guess they are technically. Where I'm going with this with the paleo diet is basically I've heard some people say it's just eat more meat, right? And take out your grains and stuff like that. But given what we know from the actual archaeological record and these samples that were taken and then analyzed in this way, it wasn't just eat more meat. It was eat more of a lot of different things.
Yeah, it's the variety that seems to count here. Not just not processed foods, but a variety of not processed foods.
Right.
So good luck with that. That gets hard.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to take up hunting anytime soon. But
I mean, for most of us, that just means we're going to have avocado toast in the morning instead of like, you know, I don't even know what else. Cereal. Yeah. Yay, paleo diet.
So, avocado toast is like so 5 years ago. Come on, there's got to be something better than that now.
I literally don't know what else to say.
Well, it's delicious.
I know. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to end this. Those are three very different but interesting news stories. So I think we covered a lot of ground there.
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week with, I'm sure, something equally interesting.
Yep.
Probably not.
But for right now, we're going to go broaden our diets with chicken wings. So,
chicken wings. Nice.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.